Well, maybe I could start off by welcoming all of you once again and reminding you to sign in at the register at the door when you have an opportunity today, if you haven't done so, and to set up your name cards in front of you so that if you are speaking and they have the camera on you, they will have the right name card in front of you so that the folks back home will know it's really you. Well, I think that the feeling is that the way in which we're proceeding is the best way, so let's just continue in that way today. And I suggest that the order of our proceeding today should be like this. With your permission, I will call on Hugh Monahan of the Northwest Territories Government in Canada to tell us about the subsistence provisions of the COPE agreement that came into force in August this year. And then I'll ask Victor Matander of the Council of Yukon Indians to discuss the subsistence provisions of the land claims agreement that they negotiated with the Government of Canada earlier this year, but which their villages have, I believe, rejected. It is interesting, though, to see what was on the table and under consideration. Then we'll ask Caleb Pengawi and with Dolly Garcia and Weaver Ivanoff to talk about the Walrus Commission, and then Jim Kowalski to talk about the Tanana Chiefs' experience. And by the way, I should welcome Dolly Garcia to our proceedings this morning. And then we'll ask Willie Goodwin, and we welcome Willie, to talk about what is happening in the Nana region. Then we'll go on from there to Harvey Fite and James Bay, and then to Dan Gross and the Third World. I think if we get through all of that today, we'll be doing extremely well. If not, we'll greet the Third World tomorrow morning, perhaps. We have the Pribilofs down. I think they are the only people who have been able to.
The Alaska scene. To provide a couple of riders first, Don Mitchell and others were cautious to point out their backgrounds, and I suppose I should mention mine briefly, and that is having been involved in Canadian land claim negotiations from a Government of the Northwest Territories perspective, I guess in excess of a decade now, and nearly two decades of renewable resource management background in the territories, provide me with a perspective of as a resource administrator. And I must admit, after that length of time, I'm still on the sharp edge of the learning curve in some of these areas. I hesitate to admit. I don't know whether that's the function of a changing environment or a slow learner or both. Hopefully it relates to the environment. In looking very briefly at the papers, I was struck with the quality of them. But despite the similarities which we have, and that's a large geographical area under consideration, some of the physiography is the same, and the cultural attributes of the people are definitely comparable in a lot of ways. There's a lot of differences between the Canadian scene and the Alaskan scene, which many of you are familiar with. First of all, we've got an awful lot smaller population. It struck me particularly when someone was talking the other day about 56 communities in one delta system or one political complex that you have here in the Alaska scene. But we don't really have very many more than that communities in the whole of the Northwest Territories, which is nearly 1.5 million square miles of Canadian Arctic. I'm somewhat taken by the size of Anchorage. It's been 10 years since I was last here, but we, of course, have nothing comparable in the Canadian North. our racial mix is quite different. As was mentioned earlier, the Inuit in the Eastern Arctic are very, very strongly in the majority, and in the Western Arctic, the Mackenzie Valley, it's about 50-50 native and non-native population. So those different mixes create quite a different political system. Just to amplify on that a bit, Justice Berger referred to the fact earlier that my minister is a claimant from the Cope region. Our government leader will be a claimant in the Denny Métis claim. My deputy minister was involved strongly in one of the native political organizations in the Northwest Territories. So there's a lot of political strength in the native people in the Northwest Territories. There has also been quite a bit of interchange in recent years between the native political organizations and the government of the Northwest Territories, and this continues as well as in the bureaucracy. So that gives the administration in the Northwest Territories quite a different flavor, and of course causes me to comment on some of these papers. These differences and similarities come out clearly in reading Langdon's paper, which I think is a very thorough assessment of the current situation in Alaska, as I understand it. One of the first things that struck me, and it's interesting that Bob Gamble and I were talking about it on the plane on the way over, was some of the ideas that have been brought out in Tom Lawner's paper. And that is that it's been my experience in land claims that as you have different parties, and it's usually three in the Canadian scene, the more you discuss issues to refine what it is you mean in a land claim settlement, the more finite and legalistic the language becomes, the more locked in you get into some of these structures. And I guess to a certain extent I agree with Lawner's comment of fear of structuring these agreements in too much detail, because then they begin to hamper some of your actual objectives. I'm a proponent of building in as much flexibility as you can in land claim agreements. However, I fear some of Lohner's ideas of rationality, and that is that it's nice to appear rational, but an awful lot of these things come down to value judgments and aren't always easily rationalized and structured. The point of disagreement I would have with this paper on the Canadian scene is that he, as I understand it, he's made a strong pitch that by native people joining government structures, they are in effect co-opted. That, I don't think, is an accurate statement in the Canadian North, because as I've just indicated, the at least at the territorial government level, the native people are clearly in a political majority. So I wouldn't see the territorial structures as co-opting their interest, but helping to integrate their interest with the broader environment or the total political environment in the Northwest Territories. Don Mitchell's paper also struck some common chords with my background. I think his strong pitch that we have to look at the social and economic aspects of resource management are very important points when it comes to implementing land claims, that subsistence is often defined in the narrow legalistic sense of sort of hand-to-mouth operation or survival on the land. But as we'll see when we get into the Cope claim, subsistence in the Cope claim and to a significant degree in the TFN claim and in the current negotiations with Denny Métis has a broader meaning. It means maintenance of the renewable resource-based economy and a high profile within that for Native people. That is seen as an essential element of them being able to maintain and enhance or maintain their culture and evolve over time in a new system. Despite my leanings towards some of Don Mitchell's ideas, which are essentially technocratic in nature, I guess that's my background, I couldn't help but be on side with some of Gary Holthus's comments, and that is that as careful as we build administrative structures to maintain this renewable resource-based economy, and as careful as we write land claims to protect the particular and special rights of Native people, the onus, I think, in many ways, with that structure in place, comes back to the people themselves to make sure that they do focus on that economy and that culture, and after all, they carry the weight for maintaining it in a changing world. And his comments were sobering, but I think very thoughtful, and I guess crystallized some of my own concerns in that area that I've picked up just as an individual, as I say, in the field for some time. Okay, in the Canadian North, then, Native people, I think, have moved very strongly in a number of areas. As I indicated, entering the political system, they've also entered the administrative structures, and through that, in effect, are setting policy for the development of the renewable resource-based economy and the maintenance of their culture. And I think the final hard step that's being taken is the entrenchment of their particular rights through land claim settlement, land claim settlements, plural. And I think the combination of those in the Canadian North are going to guarantee a very substantial role for those people in the governance of our country and the maintenance of their culture. Quick comment on status of claims. As was indicated yesterday, the leading edge on all land claim negotiations in the Canadian North has been fish and wildlife, plain and simple. They shoot for wildlife agreements first because that is the closest to the core of their existence, it would appear. The Dene Métis, although they started on a claim nearly a decade ago, have just gotten into the details of a wildlife agreement since this past spring. We're right into the middle of it, and as a matter of fact, there's meetings set up for next week, and I wouldn't want to predict when there will be an agreement in principle on wildlife, but as I say, we're well along our way. The Inuit Tapritsit of Canada, their northern NWT component, the TFN, first started serious land claim negotiations with a wildlife agreement in 1973. It progressed. There was a lack of support for some of the initial negotiations in the communities. It fell by the wayside. It picked up again several years ago, and in effect there was a wildlife agreement in principle initialed by the negotiators, but was found unacceptable to several federal departments in a couple of sections, and that's where things sit at the moment. It could break loose again. It depends on, I suppose, the political will and on both sides and how much urgency they attach to it. The COPE agreement, which we'll be into in a sec, as I indicated, has been ratified and passed into Canadian law this past summer. We have not yet made the legal changes to our legislation in the Northwest Territories, but we're in the process of gearing up for implementation of that agreement. It's a very complex document, and it's going to take quite a lot of goodwill between our government, the federal government, and the claimants to work out the detail of implementation over the next several months. To get to the specific issue of subsistence, to give you a couple of minutes of background, the Northwest Territories, the history has been that very, very large parts of the Northwest Territories have been set aside as hunting preserves for Native people, historically, dating back to the 1920s and 30s, when there was beginning to be a large influx of Southern Canadians, the federal government moved quite assertively to create these very large hunting preserves for Native people to protect their particular interests. A very limited number of non-Native people were granted what is called a general hunting license, which permits them essentially the subsistence way of life. These general hunting licenses were also issued to Native people, and that has in effect been the core of our subsistence policy in the Northwest Territories. Clear prior right has been granted to Native people, limited access to non-Native people, and the ongoing access for both has been guaranteed as hereditary right in the case of the Native people and privilege in the case of non-Native people. There have been, through the last several decades, stronger and stronger local and regional structures created for local hunters and trappers associations, dominated by Native people to, in effect, allocate their harvest and to make recommendations on legislative changes, policy changes, and also programs. The general approach, then, taken in land claim negotiations by the Native people, as I've indicated, is the primary tool in maintaining their culture has been to develop the renewable resource-based economy, to enshrine in what amounts to the Canadian Constitution their ongoing access, either exclusive or preferential, to the various wildlife resources. and to encourage government structures to be integrative. And I think one of the keys that was mentioned by Harold Spark the other day was that none of this becomes very meaningful unless you can protect habitat. And of course, that's why the porcupine caribou discussions, I think, are so critical. They have made a very strong pitch in all three claims in the Northwest Territories to structure integrative mechanisms to bring together habitat management and wildlife management in the Canadian North, and then to give themselves a high profile in those structures. And I think they've done that quite effectively. They've also made it clear that their access to the resource has to be more than, as I mentioned, the narrow definition of subsistence, but by far and away, they're given preferential rights to the commercial use of wildlife. By that, I mean either direct sale of protein, byproducts, or commercial outfitting and guiding services. And finally, when there is a form of non-renewable resource development in the Canadian North, besides having access to the various review mechanisms, there are specific clauses built in compensation. If a resource is reduced and the net benefits to the people as a result of that are reduced, there are compensation sections to allow the people that depend on those resources to be have their interests covered. Okay, given that introduction, Bob has given us specific sections of the COPE claim, which I'll refer to, and that might help explain the COPE claim. Again, I'd like to put in a rider that the perspective I bring to this document is that of a Government of the Northwest Territories negotiator. I was not part of the Inuvialuit negotiating team, so you're getting the perspective of a territorial bureaucrat on any interpretation that you ask for. I think the key element is a principle stated right on the first page, and we've talked around some of these things, but I think it's worth referring to them.
Is this the Western Arctic claim with the...
That's correct.
The one you're, yeah.
Just right inside the cover on the bottom left-hand side, the principles that governed our negotiation of that claim from all three perspectives are stated very tersely, and I'll just repeat them because I think it sets the frame here. The basic goals expressed by the Inuvialuit and recognized by Canada in concluding this agreement are: A, to preserve the Inuvialuit cultural identity and values within a changing northern society. The actual meaning of that became, I think, important in the commercial aspects of the claim, where they said, look, we want to change and take advantage of a changing environment. We don't want to be locked into traditional methods of harvest and traditional levels of harvest. So a phrase like that became very, very important when we got into the mechanics of the claim. B, to enable the Inuvialuit to be equal and meaningful participants in the northern and national economy and society. That section was used very, very strongly, not necessarily in the renewable section, but by getting, by guaranteeing agreements for people to enter onto their lands and also preferential economic opportunities that weren't related to renewable resources became a key tool to implement that principle. And C, to protect and preserve the Arctic wildlife environment and biological productivity. And for any of those who have gone through the details of this document, you'll see quite elaborate structures to guarantee adequate environmental review processes and integration with land use planning. Land use planning is referred to in this document, and although it's envisioned that there will be an NWT Land Use Planning Commission for at least the Western Arctic, they've made it very clear that within the Western Arctic region, there will be a land use planning group, of at least half of which must be Inuvialuit. Now, whether the other half are appointees of civil servants or simply appointments by government of other northerners is left fluid. But they clearly see that as being one of the main planning forums to determine where land use and resource development is going in the Northwest Territories. And I think that'll be an increasingly important structure in time. Another key element of the maintenance of habitat we discussed at length yesterday, so I won't go into it. Bob gave a good summary of what they've attempted to do with national parks in the North Slope and other land use regimes there that will protect resources, in particular the caribou management herd. It's interesting to note in their regime, which was referred to on page 19 for east of the Babbage River, this gives you a flavor of the criteria that they see being applied to any land use activity in that area. First of all, there has to be a thorough analysis from the standpoint of conservation and harvesting interests of any proposed land use. The applicant must also clearly identify any alternate locations for that form of development. There must also be a clearer statement of the environmental and social effects. There must be a clear weighing of the interests of the users and conservationists in any resource development decision. There must also be clear assessment of the ability of the applicant to carry out the development in a fashion that he's indicated he wishes to. In other words, he has to prove his credentials to develop in that particular area. And then there has to be the bureaucratic machinery in place to make sure that the development is monitored and conducted in the fashion that was suggested in the first place. So clearly, they've built in detail to give substance to their claim to environmental protection. As referred to on page 20, I see in other pieces of legislation, Native people have been given the right to trade and barter amongst themselves. And that also applies to Inuvialuit in the Western Arctic region, particularly the North Slope. But I should add to that that in the Northwest Territories, it's trade, barter, and sale. In other words, claimants can sell, for example, caribou meat amongst themselves or game meat. The rationale here is that, and it's been raised by people around the table, that even though a Native person may live in one of the larger centers, he still has a dependence, both physiological and cultural, on wild game meat. And he may not be able to provide that for himself because of the particular position he's in industry or government or whatever, but professional resource harvesters that are also claimants should be able to provide that requirement for him and gain from it economically. As I say, that applies in the Northwest Territories. It does not apply in the North Slope.
Well, excuse me. Nelson Frank pointed out yesterday the fact that under Alaska's subsistence law, the urban Native people don't have access to fish and wildlife resources for subsistence. Are you saying that this agreement ensures that urban natives in the Northwest Territories have subsistence rights? Is that the point?
That is correct, and it's ensured to them in two ways. First of all, they can directly get out and hunt and harvest themselves, or if they're not in a position to do that, they can acquire the products from other hunters who are more directly reliant on the land. Depending on which species you're referring to, there could be a limitation based on the percentage of access to harvest that the Native people have themselves. In other words, the Native people themselves at some point may choose to ensure a larger part of that harvest goes directly to people dependent on the land as opposed to those who have other economic alternatives. But in general, both have full access to the resource. I should mention again, we touched on it briefly yesterday, that the only two overall riders on access to resources by Native people are first of all, conservation. The conservation limit is an absolute limit and cannot be exceeded. And the method of take is governed by public safety. There are some fine-tuning, but those are generally the two overriding principles.
Thank you, Hugh. Any questions for Hugh before we pass on? Bob Childers?
Yes, Hugh. You mentioned that caribou meat or other wild game products can be sold Are there any limits on the conditions of that sale? That is, can they be sold in a commercial or profit-making enterprise, or is this sale at cost, or are there any limits at all in that way?
No, the conditions that are imposed on it relate to conservation. They relate to the access to the resource by others. But within that part of the commercial harvest that, claimants have, they can sell it at a profit. However, the laws of general application and respective controls are fully in place to make sure there's proper documentation and that the harvest can properly be controlled.
Yes, Willie Goodwin.
The issue of establishing parks, et cetera, you know, I'll bring up an example here. There's some people within the National Park regime that are pretty negative toward Alaska Natives and how they use the land. How is that being perceived or observed by the Native peoples of Canada, and how are you getting around future land management plans to resolve that question?
This was touched on briefly yesterday. The overriding principle that's being used in the Canadian North on land claims is that claimants will continue to have access to all conservation lands for the purposes of hunting within the conservation limits, within the laws of public safety. And in some cases, there may be particular characteristics within the conservation area that must be protected to maintain the integrity of the area, in which case the native hunting right could be curtailed. The degree to which that would apply is still under discussion in the Mackenzie Valley and in TFN. Perhaps an example I might give is that, for instance, sheep salt lick in the South Nahanni River. Although native people would presumably have access throughout the South Nahanni Park to hunt, there could be a restriction that would apply to the hunting in the neighborhood of say, a salt lick. It would create some considerable confusion and turmoil if you had regular tourists visiting that salt lick, which is a unique site, and having shooting of sheep at the site at the same time. So obviously, you know, in very, very special areas like that, controls are in place. But in general, the principle has been that the management regime inside the park must as closely as possible reflect the management regime outside the park, and that includes both the conservation limits as well as hunting access by native people. There is no hunting access by non-native people in national parks in the Northwest Territories, although there are in territorial parks.
But do you say the principle is at the start that native people have hunting rights within the parks?
That is correct. Would it be helpful, just before we get into too many more questions, that I just refer to the subsistence criteria and the actual rights of access they have to different species on preferential and exclusive grounds? It should just take a sec. You'll note on page 21, I think there's an important reference which we should refer to just for a second on the subsistence criterion. You'll note that it relates to food and clothing, which is obvious, use patterns and level of harvest, which has been is an eye towards what people have traditionally used, the particular requirements that native people have for particular species. And I think that's one of the points, Woodrow, that you got into yesterday, is that people require certain species at certain times of the year. And that has been acknowledged in the Cope claim and is being acknowledged as well in the other claims. D is an important one because it speaks to the availability of wildlife populations, in that you don't necessarily want to lock a group of people into a harvest of 1,200 caribou if that's what they've traditionally had, because if for some reason the caribou don't show up in a particular year, for example in a clavic, then there's a very significant dependence on Dall sheep. So you have to look between species for an ongoing protein requirement, and that's covered by that section. Also under E, projections of wildlife population trends. If you've got a population that's going down, there may be a greater dependence on other resources while you're trying to rebuild that population. And then clearly national and international obligations. The wildlife compensation clause is on page 22, and Heather Myers is here of our department. She has worked extensively on a compensation program and policy for our department. It's in draft stage, and I would encourage any of those of you that are particularly interested to discuss it with her. It'll be finalized shortly and be operational shortly in the Northwest Territories. The other key section is harvesting rights, which applies throughout the Western Arctic region for the COPE claimants. 14.6A, they have preferential right to harvest all species of wildlife, excepting migratory non-game birds and migratory insectivorous birds, for subsistence usage throughout the Western Arctic region. They have the exclusive right to harvest fur bears, including black and grizzly bears. Exclusive right, by definition, in this agreement means that they can either take the resource directly themselves or sub-allocate it to others, for instance, through guiding and outfitting, in the case of bear, or to permit other people to trap. In that case, then the laws of general application that are created by the territorial government apply. They have the exclusive right to harvest polar bear and musk oxen, and as I indicate, that is also implies the ability to delegate that to others. And they have the exclusive right to hunt on their own lands. There's also sections that are built in here for reciprocal agreements with other native people who abound in their area.
Willie, could you pull the mic a little closer to you?
Are those exclusive rights subject to game management that the Canadian government impose on you? Like we have that right to subsist on our lands, but we have to abide by the laws that are established under the state fish and game management plan or federal.
They're subject to the laws of general application only to the extent that those laws of general application can be justified on the grounds of conservation or public safety. In other words, you can't use the laws, other laws of general application, to curtail the native access to resources and reduce their allowable harvest. It clearly has to be justified under conservation of the resource or public safety. With only a few minor exceptions, that's true throughout the Western Arctic region.
Dick Nelson.
Yes, I'm curious to know if the government of the Northwest Territories has established a system of priorities or policies related to industrial developments in the lands of the Northwest Territories that might conflict with subsistence uses, or that might be detrimental to the population of wildlife resources important for subsistence. And if so, is there a clear system for stating that subsistence is the highest priority in the event of a conflict between those kinds of uses?
No, there isn't a clearly enunciated, explicit policy in respect of that at this point. We're just now gearing up for a land use planning program that's going to begin in the key areas of the Northwest Territories that are confronted with development. The front edge of that process is developing that policy. So it would be premature for me to say at this time that we've got policies clearly enunciated that would protect the subsistence way of life. We have clear statements of territorial government programs which support that way of life. We have a clear priority by our political leaders to maintain that way of life, but we've got to do some more work in terms of actual policy development.
Marie Adams.
I'm just curious about how they deal with in cases where the communities along the Northwest Territories, I know there are communities dependent on both land and sea mammals. How do they approach conservation when they deal with sea mammals?
Uh, marine mammals in the north, in the Canadian north, excepting polar bear, are under the jurisdiction of the federal government. Walrus, narwhal are the key resources. Our people in the Canadian north do not hunt big whales. There are quotas in place for narwhal and walrus, and depending on the area and the species, the quotas are more or less precise. In the case of polar bear, the Government of Northwest Territories implemented a quite rigid quota system in 1968, even in the absence of clear biological information on sustained yield. We looked at traditional levels of harvest before the harvest escalated due to price increases and fixed the harvest at those levels until we could get our biological information to catch up. And since then, we've been adjusting those quotas for polar bear annually. There's one last significant geographical area which is being covered by ourselves, the federal government, and two provinces over the next 3 years in the extreme eastern Arctic. Marine mammal management, meaning narwhal and walrus, has been less finite, less precise, because of the limited database. But the federal government has put a priority on that in the past 2 years, so hopefully that'll be more refined. I should mention that in the determination of harvest, that's been a combination of biological information combined with traditional levels of harvest. However, the allocation of that harvest, both in the case of marine mammals and polar bear, in the communities, we see as the prerogative of the community. We determine the number of tags, we give them to the local Hunters and Trappers Association, and in effect, say you distribute them amongst your hunters as you see fit. And in the case of polar bear, we go one step further and say you can allocate whatever proportion of those tags you want for non-residents, providing you provide the guiding and outfitting service, and it occurs within the laws of general application. Does that answer your question, or am I being too?
It does.
Okay.
How about? I've got one other question that Burton touched on a little bit. People up there, I know as much as they do in Alaska, would like to protect their subsistence resources from development where there may be adverse effects. I know there's a lot of exploration and possibly development going on now in the Mackenzie Bay area. Do you have a position that you have developed in dealing with conservation or protection of habitat?
Well, I should be quick to remind you that I can't speak to COPE's policies. I work for the territorial government. I would hesitate to. I'm not competent to indicate what their policies are.
I think David Case has the next question.
And I think it feeds off of what Dick Nelson and Marie Adams were just asking about. What, if any, is the significance of the exception from these additional development provisions of adjacent nearshore and offshore waters in the settlement? In other words, Section 12 speaks of several development provisions, review provisions to be implemented within the area east of the Babbage River, but excepted from those provisions and subject to the normal government process are adjacent nearshore and offshore waters. And is there any significance to that? I mean, is there likely to be a lot of development in those waters, or is this of less significance?
I hesitate to speak to the detail of it. One other writer I should have put is my involvement, or our negotiation of this agreement took place quite some time ago, and I was rapidly trying to remember some of the detail of that negotiation last night as I went through this. So I don't know that I can be helpful in specific terms, but I think in general the reason for reference to some of that north coast or the North Slope is that because that is occurring in a different jurisdiction. That is in the North or in the Yukon. By definition, anything beyond the tide mark in the north of Canada is a part of the Northwest Territories. So any offshore activity then gets swept in to the Northwest Territories review regimes, which they've been guaranteed access to through land use planning and so on. Land use planning in the Northwest Territories is thought to include the offshore. For reasons that Marie was alluding to, is that particularly for our coastal people, we find it impossible to isolate the land from the marine environment. So we see it as one continuum, and I'm assuming that would be swept into Northwest Territories land use planning.
Right. Well, maybe we could move on to Victor Matender then, and Victor, you could tell us about the CYI, or Dave Porter, one or other of you could tell us about the CYI agreement.
You're going to be lucky. You're going to get both of us this morning.
Okay. Well, Dave Porter first, for the record.
First of all, I would like to express our appreciation for being invited to speak to this commission. On a more personal level, I'm particularly gratified for the opportunity, in as much as I miss the opportunity in the valley. A couple of days ago, if you believe what the deep thinkers were saying, you would have thought that subsistence culture had been deep-sixed. I think that it's very important to make a statement to the effect that it is very much alive and is functioning out there. We realize that our culture today is not pure, and no culture can continue in a pure form. We realize that our communities have been tremendously impacted by the technological changes that have been brought about by urbanization and the introduction of the wage economy to our part of the world. And we realize the kinds of changes that has made to our lifestyles. But that does not detract from our responsibility to protect what exists out there. And in many of our communities in the Yukon, as well as Alaska and the Northwest Territories, many of our people continue to live primarily a subsistence-oriented lifestyle. None of it is pure. None of it is totally a subsistence economy. It's an integrated economy. It's one that coexists with the wage economy. And at one time, we were told that was not the case. Through the efforts of people like yourself and Peter Usher, we've been able to, I think, in the Canadian North, demonstrate to the larger Canadian public that it does in fact exist. We've done tremendous work in terms of documenting extensive land use and occupancy studies throughout Northern Canada. And so there is no longer an argument from our perspective as to the viability and to the effectiveness of our subsistence cultures. And it's also very important for us to be here from an educational sense. There is an awful lot that is occurring now within this state that has a direct bearing on our part of the world. We are involved in the process of attempting to establish agreements, contractual agreements with the governments of Canada with respect to the question of Aboriginal rights. You've had the experience in this part of the world of having to live with such an agreement for 13 years. And so many of the issues that you're talking about here today that we're addressing at this particular meeting are issues that we are being asked to come to a legal contractual arrangement on with the federal government of Canada. So it is a very important place for us to be right now to learn and hopefully to be able to take the knowledge that we acquire here and